This is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News, brought to you by thefreepress.org. WCRS Community Radio 98.3 and 102.1.
Hi, this is Bob Fetrakis with The Other Side of the News. I'm here with Paul Loeb, author and citizen activist. You may have seen some of his best-selling work like Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible will take a while.
A little while.
A little while. The Impossible will take a little while. A famous Billie Holiday quote. So, Paul, what's going to take a little while? What are you working on these days?
Well, I'm working on a couple of different things. I mean, I just had a new version of Soul of a Citizen where it was out for about 10 years, sold about 100,000 copies, and then we decided that it was time to update it. And so just lots and lots of new stories. A lot more interestingly, in that first version, I had, I think, two sentences on climate change. And I've added just all sorts of just real powerful stories, I think, of people actually making headway in shifting things around. And to me, it's such a paramount issue. Well, in some sense, it's an issue that people have never had to face before, anything comparable. I mean, the arms race certainly threatened annihilation, but it had more straightforward solutions. And so I talk a lot about ways people are making progress on that and just what does it mean to be alive these days and try and struggle for some kind of justice and try and struggle for a more sustainable world. And so I do that. And I'm doing a new update on The Impossible. It'll take a little while, bringing in some authors I've always wanted to include and also running a project to get students involved in the election. So pretty busy, I think.
Yeah. What do you mean the soul of a citizen? The soul is often thought to be a religious or transcendental term.
Right. Well, in my view, certainly for some of the readers, they resonate to that in that sort of religious language. But I think whether one's religious or secular, you've got something at the core of your being that's driving you. And so that's what I'm saying, is that essentially, we see these things around you. We see poverty, we see climate change, we see widening economic inequality, we see, assaults even on the right to vote. And to be able to challenge that, we need to be able to not just sort of be robots spouting off abstracted numbers. We need to tell a human story. And I think that that's what people respond to. So to me, part of my writing in books like Soul of a Citizen is to try and give people the tools, particularly the psychological tools as well as the historical ones, to be able to take stands even in difficult circumstances and draw from people who have gone before. Because, we say that this is a hard time to act, and in some ways it is. But you compare it to Nelson Mandela, 27 years in a South African jail, or the people fighting those Eastern European dictatorships, or, going into Mississippi and the heart of the civil rights movement in the U.S. And, in some ways, I won't say we've got it easy, but certainly the threats that we face when we act are far less, and the consequences maybe for most of us are probably far less. And so I think we just, we have an excess of timidity, and part of what I try and do is to give people the courage to take on difficult tasks and challenge powerful institutions.
Is it harder to be a citizen at this point in history with paralysis and divided government?
I think in some ways, because if you say, all right, this is what I want to see done, and if I can just elect the right people to do it or persuade the people who are in office to do it, then it's a task of gaining enough power to be able to do that. At this point in some areas, we have sort of a terminal gridlock where you can put a great idea out and people won't even get a serious consideration. But I also do think that people are able to build power and shift things. I was just, this is 2 weeks ago, I was in Wisconsin talking with some students there in a school I was visiting, and this young woman was on the, I think it was Wisconsin, no, actually, it was Minnesota. I did the schools back to back. It was a Minnesota school where this happened. And she described they were trying to do a state version of the DREAM Act to basically allow people who grew up undocumented to go to higher education, and even though, you know, they didn't have legal papers. And she described going with some other fellow students and telling the story of a friend of hers, or her closest friend in high school, who was Bosnian, who was not a legal citizen. And she went on to college. Her friend could not. And, you know, she said it was just this, you know, this young woman was smart, who had gotten excellent grades in high school. You know, we had everything going to her, and suddenly her future was being just absolutely stopped. And she actually succeeded in changing the mind of her legislator, which was a pretty powerful thing to do. And I'm not saying that that always happens just with good arguments. I'd say probably that's probably a minority of the time. You know, most of the time it happens from building power. And you have enough people, you organize people, you register voters, you get them out to the polls, and either you change the legislature or you put a little bit of fear of God into them that if they don't do at least some of the right things some of the time, they're going to be out of office the next round. And you do that again by building power on the ground, by organizing. It's more than just the convincing and good arguments process.
Well, one of the things that seems different from the social movements of the 60s and early 70s is a lot of students, I recall in Ann Arbor, places like that, Berkeley, actually not only registered to vote, but ran for offices,
right,
took over city councils, and actually helped reshape through example what a community should look like. Will we be seeing more of that in the future?
I'm hoping that we will. I was just in Virginia, and I was this woman I was having, a group of us were having dinner, and she described had been at James Madison University in a town called Harrisonburg, and there was a student named Kai who had initiated, it was called the Orange Band Project on campus, where people put sort of different projects that they cared about to get issues that they cared about to get the students talking. And he then ran for city council, and she had sort of half jokingly said earlier on, well, if you ever run, you know, I'll be your campaign manager. And so he held her to it. And somebody came up, you know, she was talking with a friend who said, oh, Kai's going to learn so much from this. It's going to be a great learning experience. And she said, you don't understand. He's in it to win. And he did. And because he got the largest number of votes, he became the mayor for that term, and he just got reelected. There was also a current student in, it was William and Mary College in Williamsburg, where they just organized the hell out of the campuses and got people down to vote and took a council seat. So I hope that there's going to be a lot more of that, because it's certainly a way that students can make an impact. I mean, lots and lots of stuff that affects their lives, and it's accessible. And the scale, I mean, if you compare it to, I don't know, it's people should be participating in U.S. Senate races or gubernatorial races in the state of Ohio, but certainly the scale of feeling like you can see the visible difference you make is much, more accessible if you're talking about a local council race or a local school board race or something like that, or local legislative seat. So I hope they will. I mean, that said, they also can make a difference. I had an experience. I live in Washington State, and 4 years ago, I was canvassing on election day, for one of the gubernatorial candidates, and I got three people out to vote who wouldn't have before, which wasn't anything to do with my particular persuasiveness. One of them needed a ride to the polls, and I had a number for that. One forgot it was election day, and one what was the third one? Oh, had an absentee ballot and didn't know what to do with it. And so anybody else walking the exact same precinct would have had the exact same results. And after three recounts, the candidate I worked for won by 133 votes in a state of 5 million. And I recognized that had 50 fewer people volunteered on my side, the other candidate would have won. Had 50 more volunteered on the other side, their candidate would also have won. So I think that it's enormously valuable to participate in these really localized races. At the same time, sometimes we just don't literally know the impact we're going to make, even in something like a statewide race. I mean, I'll give you one example just from this recent weeks. When people sort of say, I mean, students say to me, my vote doesn't matter. And I said, well, you know, you just don't know how close it's going to be. You know, I mentioned this race of mine in Washington, or the I think it was 333 votes in the United States Senate in 2008, and it almost got decided by somebody who voted for the eventual winner, Al Franken, but then scrawled lizard people on his ballot, and the board, in looking at it, decided they couldn't tell whether he was voting for Al Franken or lizard people. I'm certain it was a guy that did this. I just can't see a woman doing this. And, you know, that was how close it was, you know, enormously close. And, you know, at the same time, we look and we say that, you know, our vote can matter. I was looking recently at the rejection of Larry Summers for head of the Federal Reserve. And it was a done deal. I mean, every single, you know, major media said, okay, Summers is appointed, he's going to be it, he's going to be the one. And, you know, that was the conventional wisdom. And then there was a grassroots outcry. And then a handful of senators spoke out. And those senators happened to include ones who had also won their seats by extraordinarily close votes, like the woman in North Dakota, Heitkamp, and Tester from Montana, and Merkley in Oregon. And, you know, had they not been elected and had people not really spoken out against Summers, because they just, you know, they argued that he'd helped create the economic crisis to begin with by his deregulation of the banks, you know, he'd be in there, you know, or about to be in there now, and instead it looks like it's going to be somebody considerably better. So to me, it's always a combination of you act practically, you act, you know, you've got a tangible election, you do everything you can, and then you also act to change the dialogue and the larger context.
Now, the project you're working on, how does that work? You're attempting to get students to register. Here in Ohio, students registering have been under fire. They've been challenged by various political forces. How does your project work?
Well, what we do is we work with the schools, and there's actually a legal mandate in the Higher Education Act for colleges and universities to make a good faith effort, is the phrase, to register their students. And we just say to them, look, this is, you know, some of them are going to vote one way, some are going to vote the other way, or the third way, you know, depending on how many parties are on the ballot. But if you have a moral and to some degree a legal responsibility to help your students vote, and particularly in a context where, you know, some of the new laws make it much more difficult for them to vote, the schools can actually do a lot. Because if you think about it, you know, here's an 18-year-old freshman, and they're trying to figure out the voting laws. I mean, that is confusing. And if the school actually says, all right, this is what you have to do. Here are the documents that you need. Some of them actually, you need to get them from us, like a letter if you're living in residence on a campus, you need to get a letter from the chancellor or president, or a zero balance utility bill. We'll provide them to you. This is what you need to bring to the polls or bring to register. And so they can really do a huge amount, but often don't, because they either don't think of it or they're not clear, you know, whose responsibility it is. And so we say, well, okay, form a team. Make it everybody's responsibility. Talk with each other. Integrate it when students register for classes so they can register to vote. All those kinds of things. It's all very practical, and it's, you know, we're very careful and meticulously nonpartisan, because institutions, you know, have to be nonpartisan. And so we say, this is what you do to engage all of your students. And we did in 2008 and 2012, helped a lot of students participate, and now we were originally working just in presidential years, and now we're working in off-year elections as well.
Many governments in the European Union actually go out of their way to register their students to vote when they turn 18, yes, whether they're in college and in high school. Why do you suppose we have such a different model in the U.S., which seems to vary state to state and college and university to college and university?
I mean, I'm certainly not in some ways clear on the historical origins, and probably should be. I mean, it seemed to simply evolved that power was given over to the states, and then once it was given over, I think it was difficult to retake it. Certainly, obviously, now partially overturned Civil Rights, Voting Rights Act, you know, moved somewhat towards saying, okay, there's a variance in how states can act, but if you blatantly disenfranchise people, there's a line that you simply can't cross. That now line has gotten a lot more mushy, you know, in recent months since that decision. But I think it, in part, it's embedded into our particular systems that, you know, gives a lot of power to states. I would argue that voting should be something that is essentially a sacred right and should be nationally guaranteed in a way that gives access to everyone possible. But that's not necessarily how it's evolved.
You're listening to The Other Side of the News, 98.3, 102.1, WCRS. I'm talking with Paul Loeb. I am, of course, Bob Fitrakis, bringing you The Other Side of the News. There's been some debate. Some states have made it really difficult in terms of ID. In Ohio, you can use your utility bill. Some states actually need picture IDs, and they limit it.
Student IDs are not accepted in North Carolina
even though
now.
Even though the student ID could have your picture, name, and address, that seems almost purposeful that they're trying to disenfranchise younger voters.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I mean, I think that it is in some ways. I mean, it's not universal, but where it's happening, you know, it seems to target younger voters. It seems to target racial minorities. And, you know, there's this sort of presumption that, well, I don't particularly like the way that they're voting, so I'll stop them. And I think it's something that, you know, people need to get really angry about. I mean, it's interesting because I mentioned this really close election, and I have a Republican Secretary of State. Well, he just retired, but one of his sort of proteges is now the Secretary of State. And he's a straight shooter, and when that 133rd vote in election happened and it wasn't the candidate that he supported, he said, that's the way it is. The other side won. That's, you know, that's life. That's democracy. And he's been out there engaging, you know.
There was no secret satchel that suddenly was
states. No, there was no secret satchel. It was like, this is, you know.
Oh, we forgot to count these votes.
Right. No, it was like sometimes we win and sometimes we lose, and that's democracy. And he's been working through to allow registration through Facebook and a partner. She just initiated with partnership with Facebook and Microsoft, and that would set up a secure system to register. And so, you know, he's really doing and touring college campuses, doing everything he should. But then some of his counterparts are doing everything, it seems like doing everything they can to try and deter young people from voting. And to me, it's just, it's dishonorable to use that phrase. I mean, it's shameful. I mean, again, one can have different views on policies ranging, you know, from taxation to war and peace issues to the NSA to gay marriage and abortion. I mean, on any policy around. But the right to vote should be sacrosanct, and it should be something that elected officials should be promoting and not trying to deter. It is, you know, it's a sad situation, and I hope that what will reverse it is serious pushback from people say, you know what? I like your stand as a candidate. I align with your party. But when you do this, you cross a line. I'm going to vote for the opponent until you stop doing this. I mean, I think that's the only way that it's going to shift is to build enough outrage about it.
You're listening to The Other Side of the News. I have Paul Loeb here, author, citizen activist, who wrote The Soul of a Citizen. A concept of citizenship, does that include sort of respect for people on the other side, people with different points of view?
Well, I think it does, and I think it's valuable. I mean, let me give you an example from Soul of a Citizen's new edition. So there were these meetings set up it was a sort of Democratic activist and a former Republican congressional candidate who set up these meetings to try and bring people together across political divides and just these sort of confidential conversations. I attended one of them. I got to, you know, have dinner with Grover Norquist. Was kind of interesting, you know. and so very charming, actually. and
did he try to drown your project in a bathtub?
No, he didn't. But we can't talk about what we said without permission. But he actually, no, I didn't. But one of the things that came out of that at some of the other meetings was the co-founder of MoveOn.org, progressive liberal group, became friends with the communications director of the Christian Coalition, very conservative group. And basically they bonded over the fact that they were both moms, and you know, they exchanged pictures of their kids and were just talking about them, and they liked each other even though they disagreed on practically everything. And they just kind of kept the friendship going. They had occasional conversations, and then this is a while ago, although it's now happening again. Verizon, together with Comcast and AT&T, did a power grab to try and control not just the broadcast, the channels of communication, but the content that could be transmitted on it. So basically, if you're talking on the phone, Verizon does not have the legal right and is explicitly prohibited from saying, "We don't like what you're saying, click, we're going to cut you off." Now, the NSA may be listening in, but that's a different story. So what happened, though, and I wrote about in Soul of a Citizen, is they tried to pass a law that said that they could, in fact, control the content on the new media. So, for example, when NARAL Pro-Choice America sent out a text message to their list, it didn't reach the Verizon subscribers because Verizon cut it off. And when AT&T was broadcasting, it was a live Pearl Jam concert, and Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam spoke out against Bush, they cut off the sound. And so, you know, fundamental, you know, as we shift to these different technologies, enormously important issue. And Joan Blades of MoveOn called this woman Roberta Coombs and said, look, I'm sorry, Michelle Coombs, Roberta's her mom, who's the head of Christian Coalition. And she calls Michelle and says, look, I know we're on the different side of everything, but this really affects all groups, right or left or center or wherever. And, you know, have you thought about it? And Michelle said, yeah, actually, it really is it's a terrible approach. And so they agreed to join forces and delivered, I think, a couple of million names on petitions. And the petitions were all over the political map. They did a joint ad in the New York Times that said, I think it was Christian Coalition and MoveOn, I can't remember which one was first, respectfully agree that. And it turned everybody's head because everybody knew that they're on different political sides. Christian Coalition work is very anti-abortion. They did their head did a joint op-ed in the Washington Post where they had a Planned Parenthood against this, and it stopped it. Again, it's now coming back again because it's like the undead or something. You know, they're hard to kill. So, but the point is that it took a cross-political dialogue, and it took a cross-political alliance. To stop it. And then, interestingly enough, at another one of these gatherings, the Christian Coalition person met Al Gore, was really impressed. She'd been ahead of the South Carolina Young Republicans, totally different politics, been a Bush delegate to the convention. And she said, you know, he actually seemed kind of really nice personally and thoughtful, and what he said was compelling. So she ended up taking the climate change training, and they're now working with National Wildlife Federation, lobbying to do something about climate change. So I would argue that there's just a tremendous value in, I think they can read the story in Soul of a Citizen, or look it up in soulofacitizen.org. There's a tremendous value in these kinds of cross-partisan alliances when you can create them. You can't always.
Well, you're talking about some corporations there. I mean, we live in an interesting time as it's evolved, where there's natural-born citizens and then there's unnatural corporate citizens who seem to be getting more and more rights, and money is speech. Is it hard to be in a citizen and be active in an era of Citizens United? It seems like that's done more to disunite citizens than just about anything.
I think it's true. I mean, and what, you know, it's not that there wasn't a lot of money in politics that undermined democracy before. There was, but it just opened the floodgates. And partly because, the one prohibition is you can't explicitly coordinate. What that meant is it is much easier to say that candidate X, if you're an outside group, basically kidnaps small children on the street and eats them for breakfast, then then the candidate Y is a good person and this is what he or she actually believes. So it's tended to skew things, if everything, anything, towards even more negative and cynical campaigning. And I think that, you know, in the face of it, people often do feel overmatched. I would argue that there are some, the solution, again, is a kind of popular outrage. You know, the one little window that the Supreme Court did leave open was they explicitly allowed things like the Disclose Act, which came within one vote of passing the Senate, but where states like Montana are now proceeding on a state level, where they basically say, all right, even if we can't, without a constitutional amendment, legally stop these corporations, and we can do things like press boycotts on them. So Target, for example, was supporting anti-gay candidates. There was started a boycott of Target. Target backed off. So particularly with ones that have a consumer profile, we can do something like that. But we can also require that at the very least they put their names on the ads. And we say, okay, this is paid for by Exxon. And then people can decide, did they like that or not? That is doable within the framework of the law. And interestingly, it has extremely wide support that crosses party lines.
Now, you're updating which book now?
So I've updated Soul of a Citizen, which is sort of my overview of how to make change. And then I'm now working on an update. I'm nearly finished. Should be out in May or June of The Impossible Will Take a Little While, which is my anthology on political hope. So we have some great new stuff. I mean, we have got a wonderful story of Mary Pfeiffer on how basically the Keystone Pipeline was essentially going to run pretty much through, you know, right near where she was in Nebraska. Now she and a couple, literally a handful of friends, did this really radical step of holding a potluck, and how it grew from there, how they enlisted a staunch conservative Republican named Randy Thompson as the looked like John Wayne. He was a rancher. It's the public face of the campaign. And, you know, his slogan was, I will not be bullied. And they did this life-size cutout saying, I stand with Randy. And, you know, basically pushed it to the point where we don't know what's going to happen. But there's at least, I would say, at least even odds that Obama is now going to veto that pipeline, where when they started, it would look like a complete done deal. So great story of that. Great story from Dan Savage on the sort of evolution of the gay movement. It's wonderful. Talk by Paul Hawken that sort of been all over the internet on just sort of, it's called the earth is you're brilliant on the earth. It's a commencement talk. You are brilliant on the earth is hiring, you know. So it's like just to get people to step up to the environmental issue. So a lot of wonderful stuff. I'm just literally today working on editing some of the material on the Arab Spring, and just the goal is to essentially get people to say, yeah, we've got, you know, there are we are in hard times to be sure, but there have been hard times before. And people have managed to prevail and find the courage and inspire each other to act. So I'm feeling pretty good about it at this point.
How do you see the question of Occupy in our version of an Arab Spring?
Yeah. How does that fit in?
Yeah. How does that fit into your analysis of Soul of a Citizen?
To me, it was a little bit of, I don't know if I'd call it a tragedy, but it was I feel like it was a missed opportunity. So when I look at the unfolding of Occupy, but the questions they
raised... Was it a huge populist uprising, but it just dissipated?
I think that it was an uprising that, particularly beginning, had a lot of popular support. I mean, the numbers were not gigantic, but the diffusion was everywhere. I mean, I remember being in... It was a little Lutheran school I was speaking at in Decorah, Iowa, where the major metropolis is La Crosse, Wisconsin, you know, 2 hours away. I mean, in the middle of nowhere. And they're like, did you know we have an Occupy Decorah? And we're camping out. And, you know, I'm thinking like, okay, it's November. Are you going to go do igloos when it gets cold? And so, you know, in a nutshell, what I saw is raising exactly the right questions about power and privilege and inequality and unemployment. And people resonate. And suddenly the mainstream media starts talking about it. And I saw people coming down, checking it out, responding well, and then essentially getting caught in, you know, their own limiting, like the process where you had to attend an 11-hour meeting. And if you had kids or if you had a job, you would not be able to stay around for an 11-hour meeting. And, you know, where they absolutely had to seize and hold those urban squares and camp out in them. And yet the fact is, in, you know, most of the cities, their urban camping prohibitions, had they basically said, all right, we're going to, after a certain point, we're going to disband every night and come back every day, you'd still have had the public space, and you'd manage to avoid that confrontation. Plus, you wouldn't have gotten sandbagged by the weathers. So I think it was a missed, you know, I hope that it'll revive, because the issues are so important.
And again, Columbus, Ohio, with the longest continuous encampment, I think, because we fought so much over the permit, and maybe that detracted us. Well, Paul Loeb, thanks for being on the other side of the news, and Maybe we'll have you on again when the new edition of The Impossible comes out.
I would love that.
All right. This is Bob Fitrakis bringing you The Other Side of the News.